evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Moving more than 1 million people across a densely populated war zone to a place with no food, water, or accommodation, when the entire territory is under siege, is extremely dangerous and in some cases simply not possible.
Hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians flee Gaza City Saturday as the enclave braces for potential Israeli ground attacks.
We have so many others who are still in the prison, and some of them are the members of my political party who were in the prison since October 2021. Until today, they are not judged. We are asking today for their release.
A Rwandan opposition leader calls on the authorities to release all political prisoners.
Could justify the removal of President Ousmane Sonko from the electoral risk. Nothing, no law.
And a judge in the southern Senegalese city of Ziguinchor cancels the removal of opposition politician Ousmane Sonko from electoral lists. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians fled Gaza City Saturday as the enclave braced for potential Israeli ground attacks. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken continued his diplomatic push across seven nations in the Middle East to try to stop the conflict from spreading and reached out to his Chinese counterpart. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane reports.
Residents of Gaza City packed their belongings and squeezed into cars or fled on foot Friday after Israel called for all civilians in Gaza City, roughly 1 million people, to leave the city and head to southern Gaza within 24 hours. One resident said Israel threw down leaflets saying everyone had to leave or be annihilated, and he asked why women and children had to be terrorized. Addressing the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is a priority, U.S. President Joe Biden said during a speech on the economy in Philadelphia.
We can't lose sight of the fact that the overwhelming majority of Palestinians had nothing to do with Hamas and Hamas's appalling attacks, and they're suffering as a result as well.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Friday that conditions in Gaza have reached a new low.
Moving more than 1 million people across a densely populated war zone to a place with no food, water, or accommodation, when the entire territory is under siege, is extremely dangerous and in some cases simply not possible.
In Israel Friday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin demonstrated American solidarity with Israel after last week's brutal attacks by Hamas militants that prompted Israel to declare war on Hamas. Some 3,100 people have died this week in Israel and Gaza. Austin told reporters,
"Terrorists like Hamas deliberately target civilians, but democracies don't. This is a time for resolve and not revenge, for purpose and not panic, and for security and not surrender."
After his visit to Israel Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Jordan's King Abdullah and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Amman on Friday, before traveling on to Qatar. He was asked if he was worried that Israel was retaliating against Hamas in an emotional response it might later regret.
What Israel is doing is not retaliation. What Israel is doing is defending the lives of its people and, as I said, trying to make sure that this cannot happen again.
Blinken said the U.S. is focused on working with international organizations and partners in the region to establish what he called safe zones for Palestinian civilians. What these safe zones could look like is likely to be a topic of discussion on Saturday and Sunday, as Blinken hold talks in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Meanwhile, as Egypt faces the possibility of receiving an influx of Palestinian refugees from its northern border with Gaza, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has repeated his country's long-standing opposition to permitting Palestinians from Gaza to be resettled in the Sinai. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohamed Shtayyeh also urged Palestinians in Gaza not to leave their homeland. For VOA, Edward Iranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Egypt and Israel reportedly agreed Saturday to open the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egyptian territory to allow U.S. citizens stranded in the Hamas-controlled territory to leave. There was no agreement, however, for other residents of Gaza to enter Egypt as Israel pursues its military operations across the territory. Egypt continues to express opposition to the potential resettlement of Palestinians from Gaza on its territory amid concerns that civilians from the Palestinian territory will be forced across the border after fleeing other parts of the Gaza Strip. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi insisted Thursday that Palestinians must resist efforts to force them to leave Gaza. He says the Palestinian cause is the mother of all causes and a cause dear to all Arabs, and it is important for Palestinians to remain firm and stay on their own land. Earlier this week, Israeli military commander Colonel Richard Hecht urged Palestinians in Gaza to get out of Gaza and head to Egypt. The Israeli Defense Forces later issued a statement saying there was no official call by Israel for residents of Gaza to enter Egypt. Egyptian MP Mustafa Bakri told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV Saturday that Egypt has warned both Israel and other international parties that it will fight any efforts to try and resettle Palestinians in the Sinai. He claimed that a several-decade-old plan exists to implant Palestinians in the Sinai and use Egyptian territory as part of a Palestinian homeland. Egyptian media reported periodic Israeli military strikes near the border between Egypt and Gaza in recent days as traffic was halted through the border crossing at Rafah. Egypt urged countries wishing to send aid supplies to Gaza to send them to the airport at nearby El Arish so they may be sent to the border by truck when the crossing reopens. Various Arab leaders have urged Palestinians in Gaza not to try and leave the territory, and Palestinian Prime Minister Mohamed Ishtiyah, based in Ramallah, told residents of Gaza, controlled by the rival Hamas movement, not to leave the territory in a press conference Friday. He says the Palestinian people will not leave their land despite what he claims is an Israeli plan to force them all out of Gaza. He maintains that Israel has been trying to get Palestinians to take refuge in other countries since 1950. Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi also insisted during a press conference Saturday in Amman that his country would not allow Palestinians to flee their homeland either. He says that King Abdullah II has stated that forcing Palestinians to flee their homeland is a red line that he will not accept. Safadi went on to warn that the security and stability of the entire region is being threatened by what is taking place in Gaza. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
In Rwanda, the leader of the opposition party Development and Liberty for All is calling on the authorities to release all political prisoners. Victoire Ingabire also expressed concern that the democratic space in the East African country has sharply narrowed. Her remarks come after human rights defenders say constitutional guarantees of freedom of expression and assembly appears to be fading, an accusation denied by supporters of the governing Rwandan Patriotic Front, or the RPF. For more about the call for the release of all political prisoners, I reach Victoire Ingabire.
14 October, normally the day when I was arrested in 2010, and when I was in prison, different organizations of civil society come together to create this Ingabire Day. And when I was released, this day was remind International Day for the release of a political prisoner and a prisoner of conscience in Rwanda, because I was not the only prisoner of political. We have so many others who are still in the prison. And some of them are the member for my political party who were in the prison since October 2021. Until today, they are not judged. This we are asking today for their release.
Those who are in jail now, the government says, have broken the law. So how do you classify them as political prisoners when they have broken the law and the law is dealing with them?
Oh, that's not true. For example, the member for my political party, they are in the prison because only they have read the book called Blueprint for Revolution. And in Rwanda, there is no law prohibiting the reading of a book. So if you put someone in prison only because he has read a book, you can't say that he broke a law.
How is your call for the release of what you call political prisoners resonating among the people of Rwanda?
No, you know, among of them, they are members of my political party, the other are journalists, and they are in prison only because they did their job. They denounced the injustice among Rwandan people. That is why they are in prison, the journalists. And there are other people. For example, Aimable Karasira was a lecturer at university in Rwanda. He has a YouTube channel where he talks of injustice. He's a survivor of genocide. He talked about the crime. He was the victim. His parents and his sisters were victims of the crimes committed by some soldiers of RPF. He denounced that, and now he is in prison. He did not break any law. He told Honori the problem he has as Rwandans, victims of genocide and the victims of a crime against humanity in our country.
What do you say to your critics who are of the view that by calling for these people who are in jail to be released, you are encouraging people to break the law with impunity?
No, I don't call people to break the law. I ask the authority of Rwanda to open up a political space to access the freedom of expression. That is the problem. They used the freedom of expression, the law they had. If you read the African United Church, if you read the Commonwealth of the Values, all the organization of Rwanda is a member. They talk about the freedom of expression. This people in prison, they used the right freedom of expression. And then the government of Rwanda does not tolerate any dissident voice. That is why these people are in prison. They did not break any law.
Are you saying there's no freedom of expression or freedom of speech as enshrined in the Rwandan constitution at the moment?
The constitution also allows the freedom of expression and freedom of speech, but the Rwanda government does not tolerate, they does not allow people to use their right to express their mind.
Are you saying that the political space is narrowed and not allowing people? Because you have competed against the president, the Green Party presidential candidate, Frank Habineza, has also competed against the president. So you cannot say that the political space has been narrowed.
But you know, the Green Party is the only political party of opposition allowed in Rwanda. But you have to know which price they paid. The vice president was killed, was assassinated before his political party was allowed to be active in Rwanda. And today, you know that I lose 4 members of my political party was assassinated. 4 members of my political party were disappeared, and now 9 of them are in prison. So it is the political space is not open in Rwanda. This is why today I call the Rwanda government to open up a political space and to tolerate the dissident voices.
Victoire Ingabire is the leader of the opposition party Development and Liberty for All. She spoke with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
On this weekend's Issues in the News, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin arrived in Tel Aviv to meet with Israeli leaders face-to-face, underscore the U.S. unwavering support for the people of Israel, as well as commitment to ensuring Israel has what it needs to defend itself. Listen this weekend on VOA's Issues in the News.
More peace, new experience, and some adventure. That is the desires of many women. But what does this journey require? On this week's episode of Our Voices, we discuss what makes a woman want to leave her comfort zone for new adventurous experiences and how that journey may help her to be the best version of herself. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
Patrick Oboi Amuriat, the re-elected leader of Uganda's main opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, says he will work to unite the party ahead of the next general election. Amuriat was re-elected despite a report of the party's internal leadership struggle that is threatening to break it apart. Amuriat and Nandala Mafabi, the secretary general of the group, who was also re-elected, were recently accused of failing to account for party funds, accusations they both deny. For more about his re-election and plans for his party ahead of the next vote, I reach Patrick Oboi Amuriat in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Our first and most important preoccupation will be to unite the party. This party election has brought divisions within the party among those who competed, but also significantly a group within the party that decided to boycott the election because they had issues with the party and issues at the way the grassroots elections were conducted. And so we have got a potential split in the party. This has been pulling and pushing for nearly 6 months now, which needs to be resolved for everybody else to, you know, come back to the fold, and we move in the direction as a one direction as a common front. This is going to be one of the most important, you know, activities that we are going to be engaging in.
What specific steps are you going to take? Because even some founding fathers or founding leaders of the party are displeased with what is going on.
We intend to engage neutral arbiters, try to arbitrate the conflict and to see whether they can put their finger on exactly what has caused this conflict and whether this conflict can be ironed out within the next few months. What that calls for is both local and international involvement. So we intend to try to identify local people which are acceptable to either side, try to mediate, but also where the need arises, we are going to call the attention of international mediators who are our friends in different international forums within Africa and outside Africa to see that this impasse is brought to an end.
But do you think, as it stands now, the prospect of unifying the party is realistic? Because some people are saying it has gotten to a threshold where it's almost at the precipice of disunity, and that FDC is potentially going to be split into multiple parts, if not two main parts, with others joining other parties.
Granted, I do understand that the conflict is deeply rooted at the moment, but it's not really beyond salvation. I believe that if we put in more effort now that we have a leadership and that we are going to insist that we speak as one and not so many centers of power, the common center of power that is now elected and acceptable to a number of members of the FDC is the one that I head. And so really, our friends on the other side, I believe, have probably exhausted all the avenues, including court. And court has told them, well, look here, there is going to have to be an election. And we went ahead with an election. I think that we are going to be talking at different levels. The first level is going to be on individual level, case-to-case basis, where we are going to engage in leaders, you know, as individuals to try and impress upon them the need for us to come back together before looking at the bigger picture of some sort of institutional conversation. So
now, before you go, Patrick, what do you think the prospects are when you said that one of your
aims, or one of the party's aim, is to push for electoral reforms to ensure the next election is transparent and credible. Do you think this is feasible? Because a lot of Ugandans, I am told, and as media reports show, that they are disillusioned or they have voter apathy.
Well, I agree with you when you talk about voter apathy. Unfortunately for the politics of this country is that each time an election comes, there is renewed hope. Ahead of 2021 elections, around about 2018, I beg your pardon, the population had become totally disenchanted about elections. And then there was this new wave of people power and NUP, which revived their hope for them to believe that maybe a new kid on the block would be able to turn table. Unfortunately, this never happened. And so we are going to the population to mobilize them and say, no, look here, much as we might have hope in elections, there is a need for us to cause reforms. And we believe that once the population is properly ignited, they can then be able to push the dictatorship to accept cause electoral reform.
Patrick Oboye Amuriat is the re-elected leader of Uganda's main opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, the Buganda Kingdom in Uganda is regarded as the largest traditional group in East Africa. With its vast territories, which include the capital, Kampala, historians say the kingdom played a key role in Uganda's journey towards independence from the UK on October 9, 1962. They also say with only top 10 monarchs now in Africa, the Buganda monarchy should be preserved, arguing about its importance in establishing democracy and nation building. S.G. Mwanga Kalinabiri just published a book titled Buganda's Long Walk to Freedom. For more about the kingdom, I talked to him about the formation and dating of the kingdom, the Buganda struggle, and the kind of freedom Buganda is fighting to attain.
Buganda is rich in culture, and it has a king and a queen, and people love their culture, love their kingdom. And so, for sure, we've seen that a lot of the governmental changes, the change of government in Uganda, is determined by the political activities in the kingdom in Buganda. Most of the presidents who have come, I can say all of them, they have been brought in by the with the influence of the kingdom in Buganda. And so I would think that if there is peace at the center in Buganda, there would be a democracy in Uganda. And also currently, there is no peace in Buganda. The kingdom, it's, as I said, is running towards its freedom. And that's why there's a lot of havoc in the governance of Uganda.
What do you mean by the Buganda struggle? Because I understand the Kingdom of Buganda played a key role in Uganda's independence. So talk to me briefly about the struggle of the Buganda Kingdom.
Buganda Kingdom was there before Uganda, but in 1894, that's when Buganda was brought together with other communities to form Uganda. But in the formation of Uganda, the British, who were the conjectures of this, of the who formed Uganda, literally, they made Buganda to get married to spouses, which I could say to different spouses. I mean, the conjecture of Uganda brought together different communities with different aspirations. So at this time, Buganda is pulling its way the other side because a time of coming as one. It had its own aspirations of going this side. It wants to maintain its culture. It wants to maintain democracy. And yet other communities, they're also putting their own direction. So when independence came in, Buganda agreed and all other regions agreed to form one country. But still that bedrock of not understanding, of not harmonizing the aspirations of working together the country of different regions is neglecting all those things. And as a kingdom, which has been in existence for over 1,000 years, it sees it has a duty and sees it can provide these services to the people, like education, health, the simple roads, so that the bigger government can do other things like the taking care of the army and shoot off the country, do international laws. And so mainly the Buganda Kingdom wishes to have a federal system of governance with the king of the rest of the country. And would say that lady, and has been always advocating for federal system of governance for all regions of Uganda, which would love the system. But they, as a country, would say we can't give a Buganda king, we can't give Buganda federalism. But what we would say Buganda has been fighting for and what it's fighting for as its share, or what would make it happy, and or what the kind of freedom it would want is a federal system of governance in Uganda. And maybe to conclude with that, I would think this kind of federal system of governance, which has been put in place in Nigeria and recently in Kenya. In Kenya, it also looks like the federal system of governance, although it wasn't said it's a federal, is the way to go. Even in Nigeria, we've seen there was fighting between certain communities. Some others want to see. Would think if certain areas, territories, and countries feel like they want to have a little bit of democracy, let them be given federal system of governance to take care of their part of aspiration while they remain in the bigger countries which were formed by the Europeans.
SG Mwanga Kalinabiri just published a book titled Buganda's Long Walk to Freedom. He spoke with me from Houston, Texas. A judge in the southern Senegalese city of Ziguinchor has cancelled the removal of imprisoned opposition politician Ousmane Sonko from electoral lists. The French news agency AFP says authorities had removed Sonko's name from the list, preventing him from contesting February's presidential election. His lawyers say the judge's decision late Thursday means Sonko, who came in third in the 2019 presidential election, will be able to contest next year's race. The state's judicial agent said in a statement that the government will appeal, adding that it was still possible that he would be blocked from running. For reaction, I reach El Malik Ndiaye. He is the national secretary in charge of communications of the opposition Pastef Le Patriot, a political party led by presidential aspirant Ousmane Sonko.
The only thing we were asking for is justice, to be fair to all and to speak the law. So the Ziguinchor District Court declared the law, and only the law. So the judge showed it courage and dignity. Justice is administrated in the name of the people. So since justice is, administrated in the name of the people and not in the name of a group of individuals, regardless of their rank, so nothing could justify the removal of President Ousmane Sonko from the electoral risk. Nothing, no law, any law.
What does this mean for Sonko and his supporters? What does this mean for
you? So it just means that we can always, we are not allowed to lose hope. For example, we trust in God and we do what we have to do. And we were expecting that some judge will take the responsibility and just tell the law in the name of the people. So we were not disappointed yesterday. We really was expecting that since the beginning we have the right with us, even if there is some judge who are playing the game of the government or some groups. But we know that in the justice, those who have very good in terms of probity or morality, are far more than those who are doing such kind of things like blocking people or giving the law in the name of some groups instead of the people or the Senegalese people, I would say.
The government said that they will appeal against the ruling. If the appeal goes through, what are your expectations?
I mean, I think they should feel ashamed. I think. If you remember, a few days before, when we were at the Supreme Court, to get the right, so to get, because you remember that the administration don't have to declare who gonna participate to the race or not. It's the Constitution Council who has the right. But we've noticed that the Supreme Court, besides the magistrate of the Supreme Court, who really take his responsibility to tell that Ousmane Sonko should get his right to go to take his paper and seek for signature in order to participate to the race. But You see that the judge has decided to take a decision which, and surprisingly, which without legal basis, but just it was to do the job for a group.
What makes you confident that Ousmane Sonko is going to win next year's election, particularly when in the last election he came in third and not even second?
Yes, well, because we know that our project of change for a new Senegal is adopted by all Senegalese people and even Africans, I would say. So Ousmane Sonko is from Senegal, but Ousmane Sonko is for Africa. So all this hope coming from each of us cannot be stopped in one go by someone. It's not possible for sure. Until now, they cannot find a penny stolen by President Ousmane Sonko. They cannot find any crime done by Ousmane Sonko. His only and one fault is to love his country, is to propose a new vision for Senegal, for Africa, which is completely different from what we used to see with our systems, with our president in West Africa. And there is a system constituted around the president. In the system, you can find even people who are in the oppositions, but their willing is to stop Ousmane Sonko and his supports, because once they get they reach their goal to be president in Senegal or in Africa, it will be the end for them.
El Malik Ndiaye is the national secretary in charge of communications of the opposition Pastef Le Patriot. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Perspective is a movie based on the true story of a Middle East soldier and a suspected suicide bomber. It is a short live-action feature centered on a female LGBTQ soldier and a partner who became suspicious of a passenger while on a bus. The film, which is generating Oscar buzz in Hollywood, was released weeks before the war between Israel and Hamas. Nir Musa Shelter, a British-Egyptian, is the writer and director of Perspective. He tells me via Skype that by not taking sides in the Israeli-Palestinian divide, the film serves as a poignant reminder of the influence that our own biased perspective has when forming opinions on character.
Initially, because I found the scenario was fascinating to me. It's something that I don't think occurs very often. People think of the military and soldiers in a very romanticized way, courtesy of, you know, Hollywood. And they don't realize that being a soldier has ramifications beyond the field. It's also so in when you're outside of the field, when you're in a country, you are still a soldier. And that mentality carries through to whatever you do. And in this particular instance, it's a unique version of being a soldier. And it was a very tense moment, very tense situation, which I thought I need to share this with the rest of the world, because it feels more than just a situation. It feels to me like a metaphor for life in a weird, bizarre kind of way, which all stories to some degree do. And there's something in me said I need to tell the story to a wider audience. So that's why I pursued it. And it's based on an event that I experienced when I served in the military.
I understand that there appears to be some Oscar buzz around this movie. How do you feel about it, and how are your fellow actors reacting to this news?
It's one of those things, like I said, you never know what's going to happen. You never know what to expect. I've worked on some of the biggest films in the world as a crew member, whether in post-production or on set, on some of the smallest films in the world as well. You never know what's going to come of a project that you work on. Things that I have done, I've shot my own as a writer-director. I've shot three other short films, like I said, two other web series. And you never know which one is going to hit, which one is going to catch an audience and get really, you know, gain interest. And this short film Perspective, I don't exactly know why, but I have gotten a lot of interview requests. A lot of people have reached out. A lot of people are saying things that this is something different, that it's standing out to them. And I don't know, maybe there is something in that interaction between the soldier and the suspect in the film that translates beyond what's actually in it. And people are reading more into it than is actually there, which is, in my mind, is the sign of a good story. And I think that's why I was so heavily driven to tell the story. So in that sense, there's that part. But I think there's also the metaphor that's embedded in the story that people are reading, which, again, the whole thing about the film, in a sense, isn't really about the soldier and the suspect. It's about criticizing or dealing with how people form opinions nowadays. And that's really what the film is about, because the whole thing is seen through multiple points of view of people on a bus. In other words, they're all pulling out their mobile phones and they're filming this event between a soldier and a suspect. Now, that alone puts us in the point of view of a person observing a situation through social media. And we already come to this position with our own preset notions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And effectively, what it's saying is your own perspective depends upon what your background is, what your thoughts are, what your inclinations are, not based on necessarily the reality of the situation.
So, Nia, how are people in Israel and the Palestinian areas reacting to this movie?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt that there is a given tension there between the Israelis and the Palestinians. There always will be. As far as we know, within our lifetime, they're very likely will be. Unfortunately, how individual people are responding to it, I don't know. It's hard to say. From the ones whom have reached out and said, I saw your film and it moved something, or it did something, or made me think about something, I'd like to think that enough people are watching it and are able to extrapolate from it a more, I'd like to say, objective opinion. In other words, it doesn't matter where you fall on the side of politics, this film is not siding with either one of the sides of politics. It really is a completely neutral stance and talking about social media and opinionating and forming opinions.
Nir Musa Shelter is a British-Egyptian, the writer and director of Perspective. He spoke with me via Skype from Hollywood, California. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. During the many years he lectured at the Harvard Law School, the erudite legal scholar Professor Louis B. Sohn taught a one-year course entitled United Nations Law. This law gives a thorough analysis of the principles linking the Charter and the various provisions and chapters. At the end of the year course, the students are equipped to know how best to approach the interpretation of the Charter, and they could be of use to governments and other entities. What comes out of a year course is, one, that resolutions of the General Assembly, by and large, are recommendations, and they are not binding on member states, except for one particular one, that relating to the budgets of the organization, which also have the assessed contribution assigned to member states. For that provision, it is binding on member states. We know this because in Article 19, there are punitive measures for those member states that fail to pay their assessed contribution, such as losing the right to vote. Equally, the Security Council in Chapter 6 of the Charter make recommendations to member states particularly with the Pacific settlement of disputes. They are not legally binding, although it is recommended that they observe it. However, when the Security Council acts under Chapter 7 of the Charter, that is from Articles 39 to 51, these measures are obligatory. Even the interim measures, which are contained in Articles 14 and 41, are binding. That is before force is used. Under that, the Security Council can order sanctions against delinquent member states. And these are binding on all the members of the organization. This is a far cry from sovereign governments' unilateral sanctions, which are not binding on member states. Although some member states are using their economic and political muscles to force some states to comply with their unilateral measures. It is also important to note that while the Security Council is operating under Chapter 7, member states have no other choice but to obey it. We know this when we look at Article 2, Section 7, which recognizes that the Charter cannot interfere in the areas of the internal affairs of member states. However, Article 2.7 also makes clear that when the Council is acting under Chapter 7, no member states can invoke domestic jurisdiction. Also under Article 25, member states are obligated to accept all decisions of the organization, such as you can see in 39, distinction between recommendations and decision. It is of note that when the Security Council decides on an action, many states at times equate those resolutions at par with their own domestic laws. In fact, we have had occasions recently when military officers in democratic states fear or being accused of the violation of war crimes would tell their own government that they would not act on their orders for the use of force until they can prove to them that those orders are not against the laws of the United Nations with respect to the use of force. In light of all these considerations, it is very questionable why the Kenyan courts recently restrained the government of Kenya not to observe the decision of the Security Council because of litigants who asked the court for these restraints. After all, it was the Kenyan government that offered to provide 1,000 of its police force to help the police force in Haiti. It was also the Kenyan government that requested the Security Council to work under Chapter 7 for its concern that in carrying out its instructions, its duties, it might have to use force. And perhaps after further consideration, the court in Kenya might find it reasonable to remove the restraints so that the government of Kenya is not disobeying the legal orders of the Security Council. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
No time for story, just check it for me. I'm loving this your body. You make me feel alive. So glad you're in my life. One look into your eyes, start to fantasize. So if you wanna party with a jagger band, don't search, baby, I'm your man. I'ma make you feel good, don't you understand? Yeah, I'm the man, girl, I'm the man. If you wanna party with a jagger band, don't search, baby, I'm your man. I'm gonna make you feel good, don't you understand? I'm the man, girl, I'm the man. I'm the man. I'm the man, I'm the man, the man.
Yeah,
I'm the man.
I'm the man, I'm the man. TZ, man, I'm back on the popular demand. They waving their hands and I'm smiling, complain. They shaking the stand, ta ta ta, shake their nash. Wait, take it to a classic. Cause inshallah, we gon' be taking mad trips. It's a long time coming between you and me. I ride in glee, making you my queen. They told me loving won't be that easy, but you can't see me. I'm the man, TZ. So now we got vibe, got tea, got tea. Hakuna gabi ja
mama na kuita kuita tucheze na mitule
tunaweka magati katika
lazima uje. If you wanna party with a jaga man, don't search, baby, I'm your man. I'll make you feel good, don't you understand?
Yeah,
I'm the man, girl, I'm the man. If you wanna party with a jaga man, don't search, baby, I'm your man.
First, I wanna know, what does Mr. TZ stand for?
Mr. TZ stands for Mr. Tanzania.
That's nice. I like that. So, like, who gave you that name? Like, did you give it to yourself or did somebody say, yo?
Yeah, I kind of gave it to myself in a way because I was always, like, representing the Tanzanian flag. I'm always wearing, like, a bracelet. When I was younger, I had, like, sneakers, flags, hats, all types of stuff. So I kind of did it to myself, but like the Tanzanian community around me was like, when I would come around, they would always call me Mr. TZ, Mr. TZ. So I was like, it has a ring to it. Let me take that.
It does have a ring to it. Yeah. So, Jumbe, or Mr. Tanzania,
mm-hmm.
How did you get started writing? I mean, because you are like a jack of all trades. Not only do you do music and but you are a radio producer, you're an engineer. and now you're writing music.
Yeah.
And you're doing music, and your performance is outstanding.
Thank you.
I mean, when I saw the video and heard the music, the first thing that came to mind was Jacquier. Now, if anybody knows anything about reggae music, you know Jacquier is like an icon.
Yeah, I remember you sent me that.
How did you tell me a little bit about it?
I started, it was really like my dad's influence, to be honest, because he was all, when I was riding around in the car with him when I was little, he would always play like different types of music, African music, from like Fela Kuti to like Congolese music, Tanzanian music, but also like American music, artists like Marvin Gaye and Donny Hathaway, and you know, so it was an eclectic, variety of music always around me, and I would see how much my dad would enjoy it. He'd be singing and stuff, so that would help me, like, I mean, that influenced me, because I'm like, if music brings joy to my dad like this, like, I want to do that too. And you know, also when I was a kid, there was always like Tanzanian parties and stuff every weekend. So it's like, when we go out and I'm seeing people dancing and having fun, I'm like, I wanna make people feel that way as well. So
right, and yeah. You do that because when I listen to your music and just the whole scenery and how you pick the scene for your music, it brings you so much joy, and your energy is just like, because you're kind of like reserved.
Mm-hmm.
But when I listen to your music and see your videos, you're like, you're just like a different person.
Yeah.
But we need an audience for this next cut.
For sure.
Let's get into Where I Belong. We're going to listen to the vibe and we'll be right back.
For you. You got me smiling with my people and I'm loving ya. You see me chinny, I'm a Nazi, I'm emotional. A certain feeling I can't find and I'm devotional. Wait.
You can find me by the ocean chilling for hours. I know I'm not the type to wait, I'll go alone. Natangulia ukifika, baby, just holler. But if you don't come through, it's cool.
motherfucker. Natafta tu mapene majaliwa, got my blessings na zikamata. I mean I'm so proper, believing in myself. I got these bars, play with me, I blow your whole spot up. I'm heartbroken in the heart that I know. I got a lot of pain, but it's something I control. I got my trust in God, so don't ever call me bro. You tryna finesse me, I'ma treat you like a one time for TZ. Hey, why they scream my name, cause I run my CT. I ain't worried about the fame, cause I'm live, I'm lit. Catch me smiling on the stage, your girl call me pretty. Wait,
You can find me by the ocean chilling for hours. I know I'm not the type to wait, I'll go alone. Natangulia ukifika, baby, just holler. But if you don't come through, it's cool. My city too fly, body going up in the 255. So tell me what you're trying to do, I got plans for you.
Yo, no one is like, yo, this one's really, really good. I'm very proud of you, for real.
Thank you, thank you. I appreciate it. That's one of the most, it's one of the most heartfelt songs. Like, I get emotional listening to it.
Yo, it gives me, like, I got chill bumps.
Yeah, like where I was at mentally when I recorded it and stuff like that. It was so many emotions, like happiness that I was in Tanzania, but also like sadness because of the loss that I was experiencing, and like anger, you know, just a whole bunch of mix of feelings. And I feel like that was the perfect way for me to channel it.
Wow. And for you to be so emotional at that time and write such profound lyrics that anyone could relate to, mm-hmm. is just outstanding. And the way it hit me is because whenever I feel like that, I always go to the water.
Right.
I go to the water for clarity.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, and just to hear the lyrics and how they was put together, mm-hmm. it was just phenomenal. Yo, that
Thank
was
you.
Good.
Thank you.
That was really good.
And a fun fact is that me and the girl, her name is Nyomisia. She's a artist from Tanzania. She's currently based in Kenya, I believe. I think she's back and forth. But it sounds like we recorded it together, like in the same room, but we didn't.
It does.
We did
I
not.
Mean,
it's like
whoever put this together.
I recorded
I'm gonna tell
my parts.
African producers.
And then I sent it to, I had my friend Ibrahim, I had him listen to it, and he's like, what if we get so and so on it? And I'm like, yeah, let's see what's up. And she did it, and it came back. I remember when they sent it back, I literally cried.
Yeah, because as I'm listening to it, I'm thinking, like, who's the girl? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, like, yeah, she got... You guys connect on this track. You guys connect.
Yeah.
It just flowed. Like, he was writing it.
She wrote that.
Right.
She wrote that chorus thing. Like, I didn't give her, like, a topic. Like, hey, like, this is about this or anything like that. She kind of just went with it. And when I heard it, I texted her. I'm like, yo, like, that's crazy. And she's like, yeah, like I felt the emotion in your verses, so I kind of knew what direction to take.
Yeah, that, and I'm all emotional. You got me all flustered over here. All right, let's hear from Overdose. Let's see what you got.
Tunes.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Al Santos, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot drink medicine on behalf of a sick person. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. I don't need another high, cause I'm just flying away. My baby, give me overdose.